So the fifth of the faculties is Panya, usually translated as wisdom. So then I wonder, well, what wisdom is here right now? And I love that the question has here. Here, we're just here. Where else would we be? And where else are we supposed to find wisdom, if not here? And certainly, to talk about wisdom that's here, now, we have to be very careful not to add anything over it, here, to add projections or complications or desires that kind of get in the way of just here. And then there occurs to me a piece of wisdom that maybe to share, not because it's relevant, but because it what occurs to me. That if you want the car you're driving to stop driving, stop, you have to at least take the foot off the gas pedal. So how does that apply to here? Do you in fact have your foot on a gas pedal in your mind? What thoughts, what desires, what aversions, what annoyances and impatience, what doubts, what fears? Do we still have the foot on the gas pedal? And what is it to take the foot off and allow the car to, on its own, to come to a stop? I think that piece of wisdom arose here because I'm struck by how quiet it is in this room. There's kind of a stillness in here that was not here 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And there's a quiet and stillness in each of you, whether you know it or not. And this quiet and stillness might be a reference point to see something, to see when the foot is pressing down on the gas pedal again. When you're revved up. And then this quiet, maybe, just maybe, sometimes, might show you that you have a choice of whether to keep the foot on the gas pedal or not. That you can let go. You know, when people come to meditation, there is a kind of idea that in seated meditation that we are to sit still. This is not wiggle meditation. So to sit still. And so what can happen, especially if someone's brand new to all this, is that they've never been told to be still this way before, and they start noticing that maybe even after the fact, after they've acted, that they have impulses to move. Impulses to scratch an itch, to avoid a little piece of discomfort, to search for more comfort. And after a while they realize, you know, I'm moving a lot. And it occurs to them, maybe I don't have to do so much. Maybe I don't have to give in to every impulse to move and to scratch and to wiggle. And then they see that there are impulses to do so. And they find that, well, I don't have to give in to that impulse. I don't have to put my foot on that gas pedal. And the person begins to start having some understanding and some mastery of their impulses to act, to do. They start having some recognition of their reactivity that operates. And they have a clear exercise of agency, of choosing not to give in to that impulse. And then they see that there are other impulses in the mind, not just to move the body, but there's impulses to think about certain things. Like there might be, you know, perfectly reasonable thing to think about. What is the kitchen going to serve for dinner today? I mean, that's, you know, that could be a natural topic for meditation. And you do that for a few days in a row, and maybe after the third or fourth day of doing that, it occurs to you, you know, I don't have to do that. And so next time the dinner menu thoughts come up, the person says, no, I don't have to do that. Put it down. And we're exercising even more mastery over the mind, that we can just let it, leave it alone. We don't have to push down on that gas pedal. Wow. And this is kind of mundane things. But then you think about your high school sweetheart who became your sour heart. Now it's 50 years ago, but it's like yesterday. And boom. And, you know, not only are there thoughts, but there's now anger and heat. And that goes on for a few days on retreat. And then finally something settled down. And then you had the thought again that came up, and you could feel the volcano begin. And it occurs to you, you know, I don't have to do this. And we let go. And then there's even more mastery now over the mind, more capacity to not only let go of the remove the foot from the gas pedal, but just not ever put it there to begin with. And so then with time, there's more and more mastery over the mind. Not what the mind does, but rather what you do with that gas pedal. Do you in fact push down, or you keep your foot off? If it's down, do you remove it? And that is huge. And to start seeing more and more opportunities to stay close to maybe something like what we have here now. We have a little bit more calm than usual, a little more peace than usual, a little more stillness as usual. There might be, at times, this point in the retreat, a little bit more sense of maybe peace. And I'm pretty confident it's the case for all of you, but some of you don't realize it. Maybe you'll realize it when you get back on Highway 17. So at some point, the reference point of a sense of well-being, a sense of well-being or peace or something, becomes so acute and so clear that we notice when we're leaving it. We notice when we're starting to get stressed. Notice when we're starting to grasp. Notice when we're putting the foot on the gas pedal. And at that point, there's mastery. Oh, I know something better. Why do I give up something good for something that's not so good? Why give up happiness for unhappiness? I've been working hard, practicing here for 5 days. And why do I give so much value, importance, authority to my high school sauerpart from 50 years ago? Why is that more important to get angry about than what we have here? So this is part of wisdom. Asking these kinds of questions, kind of getting a sense of the possibility and what we're doing and what we can not do, what we can change, where we have some mastery. And that mastery grows over time as we begin seeing more and more clearly where the moments of choice are. If we don't see that we have a choice, then we have no choice. But as we begin seeing it more and more, then we have choice. And then the choice is yours. Do you enter that choice and make a choice? Because if you don't, something's going to choose for you. And sometimes it's not even you, but rather the conditioning you received from all the advertisements you've gotten in your lifetime. I gotta get that thing. You know, the latest, the greatest, this or that. Or your latest, the politicians you're reading. You have a choice whether you get angry. But it doesn't seem that way because there's so much momentum in our society. But the Dharma practice, becoming wise in Dharma practice, is to learn how to be here. Here is not an incidental place. There's a long tradition in Buddhism that says whatever your place of here is, that's your Bodhimanda. Manda is the seat of awakening. That's like saying a lot. The Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya 2,500 years ago in his Bodhimanda. That was the original Bodhimanda. But there's a tradition that says wherever your here is your Bodhimanda. And here is where, if there's enough presence of mind and attention, and this is where wisdom gets born. This is where wisdom arises. And what I tried to describe just now a few minutes ago was a piece of this wisdom that comes, so that it's not wisdom that is learned. Read a couple of Buddhist books and then you have all the wisdom you need. It's the wisdom that comes from reading the wisdom of your own heart, the wisdom of the book of your heart, the book of your mind, the book of here, really here. There's one translator who doesn't want to translate panya as wisdom. He prefers discernment. And I think the reason he likes discernment is discernment is always fresh. It's always something having to do with here and now. You discern something now. And I think that's what he has in mind, much more than wisdom, where it can kind of like, you know, if you're just carrying wisdom in your back pocket, it gets kind of old and stale. And I like to translate panya as insight. That really emphasizes the seeing now, here, to really see. That's where wisdom is, arises. But then it gets more interesting, I believe. Where does wisdom arise in you, more than just seeing? And one of the primary supports or sources for wisdom is a process, a natural process of things becoming born, not things created. The created mind, the mind that creates concepts and ideas and identities and beliefs, that's a fragile mind. That's what creates very problematic identities, very problematic worlds fueled by desires and attachments. Very strong ideas that this is who I am. This is how things are. Things will never be better. And then we start manipulating and working and thinking and trying to figure it out. And I've spent an inordinate amount of time in meditation, either trying to have a better past. That's one thing you can create. Or planning and being the architect for a better future. That's all kind of in the head. That's the creating mind, the engineering mind, the conceiving, conceptual mind, where human beings live a lot. The wisdom that the Buddha talks about, it doesn't come from that. No matter how much you think, it's not going to come from that. It comes partly from seeing, and it comes partly in the seeing, in being here, making room for some deeper birth. Sometimes the Buddha uses the word birth, something deeper that gets born. And there's a form of attention or a form of attentiveness, a form of inner wisdom that operates, that they use this very powerful word, I think. It's in the Pali word, the Indian word, is yoni. And yoni is, historically in India, meant the place of birth, where anything is born is from the yoni. And so it's yoni so manasikara is the Pali expression. Attention from the womb. Metaphorically, kind of figuratively, what it means is symbolic, is it's attention that comes from a core source, deep somatic source within. That there is this, and from there, wonderful things are born. Some of the things we've talked about this week: joy, happiness, tranquility, concentration, faith. They have it, they bubble, maybe we say bubble up, they flow up, they evolve up from this deep place. And here's an amusing analogy that the Buddha gives about this. I think it's amusing. If a chicken sits on her eggs, incubating her eggs, and everything is right, she sits on them enough, and there, you know. She's sitting there incubating her eggs, and the eggs are healthy. She could have the wish, let's not have these eggs hatch. But those eggs will hatch anyway, because the conditions are there for the eggs to mature. In the same way, someone who lives by the Eightfold Path completely, thoroughly by the Eightfold Path, they could have the wish, I don't want to be enlightened. No matter what, I don't want it to be. But you will be. That's what you're incubating. Isn't that great? So you don't have to wish to be enlightened to get enlightened. In fact, you could wish the opposite. But if the conditions are ripe for that, that's what emerges from this yoni place, from this deep place that we're incubating, that we're supporting. So partly what we're doing in this practice is learning to incubate, to nurture, to nourish a deep source of wisdom inside. And that's part of the reason why we try to stay quiet and peaceful and learn how to bring presence, attention to everything, even to the things inside which are most difficult. Not even, but especially, it's possible that's where the incubation works the best. The places where we're most hurt, the places where we're most afraid, angry, the place where we're most discouraged. These are places that we want to hold, you know, as if you're incubating an egg. Isn't that a nice image? Just kind of like, you know, maybe all those things that are difficult are part of the eggs in the chicken analogy. Those are your eggs. If you see them as your eggs, wouldn't you care for them? I don't like green eggs. Brown eggs are terrible. Blue eggs, no. That egg doesn't quite have the right shape. It's too pointed. I don't think chicken has those thoughts about its eggs. Whatever the eggs are, you hold and you incubate. So what if all the things that are most difficult for you are your eggs? Isn't that a whole different perspective? And what if all you have to do is to sit on them? or maybe it's nicer to say, sit with them. And so many of those difficulties, there's this deep process inside that will heal, deep process inside that will mature and grow something, if we can give it a chance, if we give it the opportunity. That we don't if we stay up in the engineering mind, in the thinking mind, the conceptual mind, the judging mind, the believing mind, the catastrophizing mind. So the wisdom that bubbles up from this deep place requires us to be here, requires us to see and be present for here in some kind of higher quality way that's not caught up in thoughts and without the foot on the gas pedal rushing ahead. And so there are, and one of the key sources for wisdom in the teachings of the Buddha is the other theme for this retreat, which is impermanence, inconstancy, change. And there are three forms of change, of impermanence, that are important for the growth of this path, for the maturation of this path, the ripening of this path. A lot of the language the Buddha uses for moving along on the path to enlightenment are all naturalistic. They, you know, like a plant that ripens, a tree that a fruit that comes into, you know, that ripens. A farmer who cultivates a field but can't command the plants to grow, the Buddha said. You know, stand on top of a hill, yell at those plants. You over there on the right, you're too short, get taller. So the Buddha said that the farmer can't command, but has to nourish, has to support. So they kind of this nourishment. It's all this language about nourishment and naturalness, something naturally that grows and flows and develops, is the language of how the practice develops. So these three forms, three areas. And one area is the ordinary area of impermanence, that things change. Some things change, some things die and pass away, and that everybody can see. And I've known plenty of people who are not Buddhists, not meditators, who seem to have acquired a tremendous amount of wisdom through really being sensitive and seeing the changing nature of this world, changing nature of themselves, seeing how things rise and pass, how things die. It doesn't take Buddhist practice to do that. It's what's most visible. I've known people who remarkably were light and happy around aging. Look at that. That ability is going too. Wow. The smile. Look at that. Isn't that amazing? I remember once I was still really young, probably early 50s. Or something. And one of the abbess of San Francisco Zen Center was Blanche Hartman. We were friends, and so at one point I was telling her about, I was getting into that age where, you know, you start you have the litany that you tell your friends. You know, this ails me and this ails me. So I said something, I have no idea what it was anymore. But I said, you know, this is going on. And she said, yep. if you're lucky enough to get this old, this is what happens. I never heard that before. Wow. That was a whole different twist. I was ready to get depressed. If you're lucky enough to be this old, this is what happens. So she had wisdom about aging. And I've known people who spent a lifetime being afraid of dying. But then when they knew they were dying, there was no reason to be afraid anymore. Their fear went away. And it was remarkable. It's like being with some wonderfully mature practitioner. They completely changed. Because they, you know, they weren't living in their thoughts and fears and imaginations anymore. And it all dropped away, and they're here for this. So one way or the other, we have to come to terms with change. I wouldn't be surprised if all wisdom only exists in relationship to change. I bet there's a way of analyzing it, that every possible wisdom is in relationship to something changing. So there's this, I remember many years ago learning about someone who went to their Sufi master and with a ring and said, can you write something in the ring that's some wisdom that I can always have with me? And so a week later he went to get his ring and it was written on the ring, this too will pass. Now isn't that depressing? This too will pass? Change and things passing are the bread and butter of people who do Buddhist practice. We are working actively, we're entering actively in the world of change and things passing. So Buddhism says everything's changing, everything is impermanent, everything's flowing and moving. However, it's not random. It's not chaotic, all of it. Some of it might be. We have a role to play. And how things are going to be tomorrow have something to do with what you do today. You have a role in how your impermanent life is going to change into the future. And you can make choices today that affect the future. And that's what we're doing in doing Buddhist practice. You could, if you wanted to, stay here for today and tomorrow and can keep practicing. That's your choice. We kind of prefer you did. Or, I hear that they're having a really fantastic flat track motorcycle race going on with motorcycles have no mufflers. And I can get your front row seats. And there's lots of music they're playing all the time, very loudly, sometimes to try to drown out the motorcycles. And there's lots of things to drink, mostly beer, but that's okay. You'll have a great time. So, you want to stay here, or you want to go there? I hope I didn't tempt you. I hope to set up a silly example, but depending on which of those two you do, you're changing the outcome of tomorrow. You have a role to play in this world of change. And that's the good news about change. And it isn't that everything that passes is bad news. Every time you let go of a reactivity, that's maybe good news. Every time you can let go of an attachment or the attachment falls away, that's good news. Every time that you've been gripped by fear and the fear lightens, that's a good change. And if the fear drops away, that's even better. The fact that things are impermanent, changing, passing away, is also part of the good news of practice. It's the very thing that causes us suffering is the very thing with which we can find our freedom. And so, but we have to be attuned to it. We have to be sensitive to change and recognize it and recognize our reactivity. If we can recognize our reactivity, then maybe we've cultivated the mastery to take the foot off the pedal. We have the mastery to not give into it, to let go. And this can be done in ordinary, everyday life, that even, you know, people who are not even meditators can see and how it works to some degree. The next level of seeing impermanence is the impermanence that's possible in almost like in a different state of mind than the ordinary state of mind that we go about everyday life with. And that's a state of mind that becomes settled, really settled, here. And it's sometimes it's possible to feel like you clunk. Okay, I'm here. Okay, now I'm here. And there's even you're so here sometimes that you feel like there's no tendency to wander off. Or if you wander off, it's gonna be almost like the mind begins wandering, and it's like there's a rubber band attached to the thought, and it's not going to go very far before it snaps back here. Here, you're here. And being here, really here, is kind of like being at a... if you're standing next to a river, then you can see the river is flowing. It's always flowing. If you're really here, you see how much change there is, how much arising and passing, how shifting and changing our whole experience is all the time. Not only is our experiences in our body changing, the sensations we have, the breathing is changing, our mental states are shifting and changing, and sometimes in very subtle ways. All kinds of things are changing and flowing and moving. And but also our... And this is where it gets really interesting, is that not only is our, what we see changes, but our seeing is changing. Our knowing changes. Because the mind doesn't really stay fixated on anything. It's always kind of knowing something new, knowing something new. And maybe mostly with your breath, and then you hear a sound. You're mostly with the breath, and then you think about your sour heart. And then you're with your breath. And then you think about that itch you have on your knee. And then you're with your breath. So mostly you're with your breath. It seems like you're there all the time. But in fact, if you're really attuned, you see that not only is experiences changing, but your perception of those experiences kind of in flux as well. And as you get deeper, you see that the experience of and the perception of it are all just kind of arising together, disappearing together, coming and going, flowing. And the more you can kind of rest in the river of change, the river of your life, the less you're clinging. Clinging is kind of like freezing the river. Clinging is kind of like standing and putting up your hand to block the river. Clinging is kind of like taking a bucket of water out of the river and walking around telling all your friends, look, I have the river in the bucket. You don't have the river in the bucket, you have water in the bucket. Clinging, but to really see the river is to let go, is to relax, is to soften. So that's a deeper possibility with meditation. Not easy, it takes a while for the things to get peaceful enough, quiet enough, settled enough, and clear enough, and trusting enough to really relax deeply into this kind of deeper place. And then the third form of wisdom is the, or insight, discernment, is the insight, the wisdom that is a catalyst for the mind to let go fully. Boom. It's not something we can do. There's some kind of small letting goes we can do and develop mastery over that. But we can't do the deepest attachments we have, attachment to self, attachment to life even. Attachments to being conscious. So all these deep, very deep, subtle attachments that we have. But we can have the insight that's a catalyst. That's kind of helps the mind let go. When there's enough trust, enough equanimity, enough peace. And there's a number of these insights that took. And one of them is deep understanding that there's nothing in this universe of experience that qualifies as me, myself or mine. Nothing is I can claim this is mine. Nothing I can claim this is me. Or nothing I can claim this is my true self. There's no need to convince anybody that this is true. It's not a belief you have to believe in. But there's a sit quietly enough and see the river of change. And then the mind will see at some point, none of this stuff is me. And if you're lucky, the mind's not going to say, the one who had this thought is me. Because that's not me either. And then something with this radical kind of giving up, letting up, of the I-making and the me-making that we do creates the conditions, maybe the safety, for the mind to let go in a very deep way. So that's a kind of a deeper function of seeing impermanence, to really have this letting go. The other deep insight is the insight into, if you actually can see that everything's coming and going, arising and passing, the inconstancy of experience, because what happens between the end of a thought and the beginning of the next one? On retreat, sometimes the mind gets quiet, thinking gets quiet enough, slow enough, that you might discern a gap between the end of one thought before the next one begins. What is in that gap? And what if in that gap someone says to you, without using any words, who are you? How are you going to answer that in that gap? That gap is a place where something can let go. We see the things rising and passing and rising and passing. And we see that because of all this rising and passing, clinging doesn't work. In this deep, my mind is really quiet and peaceful. It's a real insult to our conceit that we cling well, that we're good clingers, in case you had that conceit. Because the amazing thing is you realize at some point that your clinging is always unsuccessful. It doesn't feel that way because you're holding on for dear life. But we only cling to concepts. We never cling to anything real. And when you see things coming and going and shifting and changing, you become acutely sensitive to how concepts are just watercolors painting on a flowing river. You can't really make a painting, just like it disappears as soon as you try to make the painting. And so it's kind of like you're reaching out. If you ever try to grab a fistful of water in your hand, you get a little bit of water coming out, stuck to your fingers, but you know the water kind of disappears through your fingers before you can get it. Or if you ever try to grab a hologram, it's more like that. You try to grab a hologram, and you realize that all clinging is trying to grab holograms. And so, like, what a waste of energy. And so this, in that gap of rising and passing, there's a seeing that how much we live in concepts and how little they actually serve us. And then let go. Let go. So three kind of levels of impermanence. The ordinary level, the meditative level, in that level where that somehow something allows something really deep to let go. And in the teachings of the Buddha, this whole thing is a natural process. Like Nolita talked about the other day, that it goes from joy to happiness, tranquility, samadhi, seeing things as they are, disenchantment, dispassion, letting go. It's a language of flowing one to the other. This womb-like source within that we're nurturing, incubating, supporting by being here, really here, here to nurture something, here to incubate something, here to support something deep to happen that cannot happen if we're distracted. But if you're distracted a lot, the distracted mind becomes your egg. Everything becomes your egg. Anything that's a difficulty in practice becomes the egg to sit with. Get close to it. Find a way to be very attentive and see it and hold it and nurture it as if it's something that needs to be tended and cared for. And this is the wonderful thing, part of the wisdom of this practice of ours. When we do this practice, there are no enemies. You have no enemies inside in you. Your enemies might not like this, but it turns out they're just another egg. They're just something else, another thing that wants to be tended and cared for, and bring your attention with it. And as you're here, present with it, when the time is right, you'll see the change. You'll see the changing nature of things. You'll see the changing nature of your reactivity. You'll see more and more places of choice where you have a choice not to have the foot on the gas pedal, not even to put it there. Leave it alone. Take the foot off. So final words, it might be a little strange talk to give, except that it's the fifth full day of the retreat. This talk would not have made sense the first day. And so maybe there's something about what I've said today that you can kind of live with or bring close in and kind of like put it in that place where the eggs are sitting. And stay close to it and see if there's something here that will percolate and grow and inspire you to be here more fully. Just here. So let's do it for a couple of minutes in this place, this time.